Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Techromancy Scrolls, Westlands by Eric Schubach. Narrated by Holly Jackson. Prologue. I walked quickly through the Penny Library like a woman on a mission, my swords clanked lightly on my leather armor at my hips. Mother Luna. I still can't believe that Prince George had rechristened the restored Cedar Ridge Public Library main branch here at the Dig as the Penny Library in honor of the endearment the people of Wexbury had given me. They had taken to calling me the Penny Lady soon after I was raised from commoner to noble when my Lady Celeste took me on as her squire and I had become knight ascendant. I had earned the title because of my tradition of handing out penny vouchers to the commoners and serfs of our realm to ease the burden of providing for their families, if just for a day. Some nobles, who believe there should be a clear division between commoners and nobility, used the name as a slight to me, pointing out that I have commoner blood myself. I, however, choose to wear the name with pride, for I remember from whence I came. I was simply Lainey Herder. A passable techno knight and now a reluctant Templar of Sparrow, another of Prince George's cruel jokes which he had perpetrated against my wife and me. I feel our lives have become but a comedy for all the titles foisted upon us. I spent as much time in the library as I was afforded, now that the restored tomes and scrolls had started pouring back in from Wexbury Keep from the designated restoration building in the warehouse district. In just over a year, almost a full quarter of the tomes which had been in the best shape have been restored by techromancers, scholars, and mountain gypsy historians from all over the Lower Ten. It would still be years before the tens of thousands of tomes were returned to their rightful place in the library here. I glanced around the building in pride, knowing that when that happened, it would eclipse the great library of the Techromancy Scrolls of Wexbury, and even the Hall of Scrolls in the capital up in Highland Reach. The Penny Library would be the single largest repository of knowledge from the wizards of the before times in existence, and it was open to all who wished to partake of that knowledge. All realms and all gypsy tribes were welcome. Even unsavory individuals like marauders were granted free passage to use the library if they surrendered their weapons and caused no problems. It didn't matter if you were serf or noble. I welcomed all here. Part of the lands of the Dig, which I had gifted to the people of Wexbury as a treasure of the realm, had been deemed neutral territory, where the Templars of Sparrow now resided so that no one realm could claim us. As Templars, we were beholden to no one, not even Prince George. We answered only to our own moral judgments in that aspect of our lives. But I was a woman of many worlds, and none of them fit me. They were like different masks which I wore depending upon circumstances, when really, at my core, I was still just a simple chicken herder who was on the most amazing of adventures she never could have imagined a few short years ago. I still stood as Techno Knight of Wexbury on occasion, or Sora of the Lupe clan of mountain gypsies at others. I was also in the unique position of being a noble of not only Wexbury, but of both Highland and Solomon as well, as a result of my misadventures. Not to mention the nebulous connection between Great Mother Rennell of the Mountain Gypsies and my family, which she refuses to explain to us. As I said, I was a woman of many worlds, none of them mine. I passed dozens of library patrons in the colors of all the realms of Sparrow as they moved around the great space with wide-eyed wonder. I smiled in acknowledgement of their greetings and frowned at those who bowed as I passed by. I wish they would stop doing that. I hesitated when I saw my mother-in-law, Emily, leading a group of wide-eyed children, along with the instructor of the keep, Jacqueline, through the main corridor toward the sea of bookcases. Emily's blonde hair shone brightly in the sunlight, pouring in through the main doors, and the electric lights that had been installed throughout the cavernous space. Emily, or as everyone in Wexbury calls her, the Queen of the Scrolls, since she is the matron of the library of the Techromancy Scrolls in Wexbury, was about the only person I knew who was shorter than myself, and she was one of the few blondes in Sparrow. Fewer and fewer children are born each year with that hair color. Father, prime Techromancer Donovan, has explained to me that it is a recessive trait and in time could disappear from the realms. I think I understand. Though I feel a fool for not being sure about the things the man attempts to explain to me at times. I'm glad that Emily has finally made an honest man out of Donovan. Celeste's father deserved this second chance at happiness after his first wife died of wasting syndrome so many years ago. Father felt he had to hide his feelings for the hyperwoman because of what he felt Celeste would think of his affections toward a woman almost half his age and barely older than herself. For the record, Celeste was ecstatic that her father had found love again. She's awesome like that. Emily beamed a huge smile at me, with that glint of mischief only she could conjure. Oh, Mother Luna, I knew that look. The group stepped up to me, impeding any chance of a stealthy retreat. I squeaked as I found myself in a hug. I noted the disheveled clothing on the children, their ages ranging from around 5 to 15, and it was my turn to open my eyes wide at the realization of who they were. I giggled with a conspiratorial tone as Emily released me. What brings the Queen of the Scrolls to the Penny Library today? I had to add in a teasing, Mother. She was only my elder by 5 or 6 years. Well, that we know of, that is. It seems my mother-in-law is quite a mystery. Everyone assumes she is noble, but nobody has any information about her before she became the matron of the library, and she always gives nebulous answers when asked about her age. It isn't until after you leave her company that you realize she never really answered. Then I looked over the children with a beaming smile. And who are these delightful children you have in tow? She winked at me, knowing full well I had already deduced who they were, even if the variety of clothing, color schemes, and styles hadn't clued me in. These? She waved her hand airily at the group as Jacqueline beamed with pride. Are the winners of the first annual Sparrow Young Scholar Lottery. Then she added, to throw my tease right back in my face, Daughter? I told myself, I will not gush, I will not gush. I gushed and beamed at the group as I said, Welcome and congratulations to all of you. All of the knowledge in this library is open to you all. Prince George was so impressed with the programs we had in place in Wexbury to educate every man, woman, and child as to not limit the benefits of education to nobles that he had made a decree that all of the realms were to adopt similar programs. In the past, it had felt to me as if the nobles didn't want us common serfs to be educated. They kept another layer of separation between the classes and made them feel superior just because, by happenstance, they were lucky enough to be born into a noble family. But in the few short years we have been educating everyone in Wexbury, we have seen positive results, improving the quality of life and sense of self-worth of our populace. So when the tomes started flowing back into the Penny Library, we petitioned Prince George's wife, Princess Everly, to somehow make it possible for more than just scholars to travel from the other realms to make use of the endless amounts of knowledge contained within the library. She commissioned a yearly lottery system, which would draw the names of 2 commoner children who have not reached majority, the age of consent, from each realm to travel to Wexbury to witness the library themselves. The travel and care of the children would be paid by the crown, as well as a stipend of 4 iron pennies to the parents of the children to offset any hardship they would experience by not having the children at home to work with them. I kept a smile on my face, though I noted the disrepair some of the children's clothing were in. A small girl with skin as dark as a starless night was holding the hand of an older boy with equally as dark skin. Their long robes with silver piping told they were from Hell's Gate. They had traveled so very far across the burning desert to be here, escorted by the prince's royal guard, and the poor girl had no shoes. The boy looked to have a keen interest at the 2 swords on my hips. I started blushing when Emily turned to the group and said, Everyone, this is Templar Laney, Sora of the Lupe of the Mountain Gypsies, and the Penny Lady of Wexbury herself. The kids all gasped. A few were visibly excited as they all started dropping to their knees in supplication. Some of the children looked around at the others, then started kneeling and bowing as well. I can't tell you how uncomfortable that always made me, and how much it made my blood boil when people did that. I started shooing them all up, frantically making hand motions. None of that, children. Up with you. Then I looked around as if I were confiding a secret to the group. You all know I am of common stock myself, do you not? I am just Laney Herder under this armor. A couple children gasped at that, and one adorable boy around 10 called out, I'm a Herder too! I knelt in front of the little one from Hell's Gate. She reminded me so much of my own daughter Misty, who was about her age the first time I met her. I rasped out, And what is your name? She looked down bashfully. It rang all of my maternal bells. It was such an endearing action. Her tiny voice wavered.
Shanicia Weaver, my lady?
I smiled at her, tilting my head so that I could see her big brown eyes. Hers flicked over to the burn scars on my left cheek, which were glowing and spilling out the wispy white magic of the people tinged amber with my techromancer magics that freely mixed with it. What a lovely name. Then I looked around from where I knelt. You may all call me Lainey. Then I looked back at her. She raised her hand to touch the wispy trails of magic that blurred my form when I didn't keep a tight rein on it. She had a look of amazement at the magic, rather than repulsion to my scars. I almost pulled back when her fingers came to rest on my cheek, and she asked in a little voice,
"Does it hurt?"
I blinked. Nobody but Misty had ever asked that particular question. Most people tend to pretend they don't see the scars. I don't mind if they do. I've earned every scar I have. They are the cost I gladly paid to keep peace in the realms. Doing what was right always carries a cost. My scars were the reminder of that for both me and those around me. I shook my head. She looked mesmerized by the mist that trailed behind. No. This made her smile. Then I reached into a pouch on my sword belt as I said, "There was another prize for winning the lottery that I don't think any of you were aware of." I pulled out a handful of violet strips of paper and placed them in her little hands. At the end of your first day here in the Penny Library, Instructor Jacqueline will be bringing you to the Wexbury Market to buy new outfits for the Holy Day Feast tomorrow at Castle Wexbury with these penny vouchers. I cocked an eyebrow up at Jacqueline, who was trying so hard to look officious but was failing as her cheeks dimpled trying to hold back a grin. She inclined her head to me, acknowledging my made-up prize. Then I turned back to Shanicia. Can you, young Weaver, make sure that each child here gets 2 penny vouchers? She nodded emphatically, her eyes wide, marveling at how many vouchers she was holding. Sadly, it was likely it was more than any of these children had ever seen in one place. I felt inspired and stood, looking over all the eyes upon me. Now I need all of you to raise a hand. I lifted my own, covered with the spell-laden white silk glove which eased the pains that would never leave my magic-burned hand. It was a gift from the rogue adept Raneth, which I received at the Battle of the Monolith to stop another Great Mage War, where I was forced to send him to his maker. The glove also hid the stump of the finger I lost to the rogue prime techromancer of Solomon, Kennick, just before I dispatched him to whatever hell he deserved. Both men were links in the ever-growing chain of sins that weighed heavily upon me in my nightmares. I paid for both victories with parts of myself. It is no matter to me, as I was never going to be pretty anyway. The children raised their hands, and I said, "I need to swear you all in as members of the junior regiment to perform a solemn duty for me upon your return to your realms." They all looked at me, eyes wide and sparkling as Emily turned her back on them, covering her mouth to stop a chuckle. I dutifully ignored her, well, except for kicking her shin in chastisement. Then I prompted, my voice raspy from the damage to my vocal cords in Solomon, "Repeat after me." Then I took on a serious tone, lending gravity to the fact I was adding them to Misty's imaginary junior regiment. Well, not so imaginary, since Prince George, just like a scatterbrained man, acknowledged it. "I swear to uphold the virtues of the rank of Knight Ascendant of the junior regiment." They repeated dutifully, causing me to smile. "To help those in need and strive to do what is right and just, and always aid those less fortunate than myself." They spoke with more conviction this time. "And to distribute a boon to those deserving in my realm upon my return." They finished, and I dropped my hand and said, "You are now sworn members of the junior regiment. Before your week in Wexbury ends, the treasurer of the junior regiment will distribute 25 penny vouchers for you to carry to your people and give one to each of the families most in need." There were gasps and excited murmurs. I added, "Do not take this lightly. Remember, you have given a solemn oath to help those in need and to strive to do good in this ever-growing world of ours." They nodded enthusiastically, the elder children looking so serious about it. Then I grinned as the children surrounded the little one as she started handing out the vouchers for their trip to the market. Emily's voice was full of mirth.
"Treasurer of the junior regiment! Just what you need to do to make Misty's head explode into glitter."
I grinned. "Oh, shush you." I cocked an eyebrow.
I best remember to send a flash to Princess Everly requesting her to make the additions to the prize's lottery program. I'll be hard-pressed to fund them myself when she hears of it and tries to have the crown pay for them herself. I still found it amazing how fast all the realms had taken to sending messages using an invention from Wexbury's own Lord Bexington and fellow Templar. Wires were run between all the realms, allowing for messages to be sent instantly using bulbs with letters painted on them, powered by electricity from paddle wheels in the rivers, windmills being mounted on every castle keep, or magic spark containment vessels. It made the information sharing so much quicker than the hours or days that signal fires or horseback riders could relay. Everyone has taken to calling the messages sent on the wondrous devices flashes due to the flashing lights. Wexbury has also started expanding the network and running flash wires to every town in the realm of Wexbury. Our scholars say that one day, they envision a network so complex that every citizen will have a flash device in their own home. What could we not accomplish in these modern times? I doubted I'd have time to speak with Everly about it at Templar Hall today. So it will have to be a flash when I return if the Wexbury grapevine doesn't get word to her by the time I can sneeze twice. After receiving his vouchers, the other child from Hell's Gate moved timidly to me. He was perhaps 14 or so, and 5 or 6 inches taller than me. He opened his mouth, then shut it, and started moving off. I laid a hand on his shoulder to stop him. "What is it?" I left a question in the air. He turned back, with a shy look on his face. Oh, Lord, he had a love-struck glint in his eye. I would have been flattered had he not been staring intently at my hips at the time instead of me.
Galen Minor, he said.
I sighed and placed my hands on the hilts of the swords he was coveting. He asked almost bashfully, making me wonder what it was with men and their fascination with weapons.
Is that Annadele and Hera?
Then he added quickly,
Is it true that small blade can cut through lightning?
Okay, I was blushing. Annadele wasn't small. She was just right for me, thank you very much. I can't help it if she is the size of most knights' parrying blades. His words caught the other children's attention as they started gathering in front of me. I shook my head. No, she cannot cut through lightning, though she has channeled magical lightning through her, which has changed her nature. She cannot be chipped nor dulled. He actually licked his lips as he looked at her hilt. I asked innocently, Would you like to see her? There was a chorus of yeses. I glanced around and held an arm wide at the other patrons who had been slowly congregating. Everyone backed off and gave me room when I dropped into one of the first Kanzet forms, drawing both blades smoothly, then bladed my body. Then I went through the Kanzet form kata. I loved this one over the other forms the weapons masters have taught. This was a mountain gypsy form, which felt more like dancing to me than fighting. It was an almost forgotten form, as there are virtually no gypsies who use two-bladed combat other than wielding a parrying blade. Great Mother Rennell herself had been the one to instruct me in it. When I had asked her how long it took to master the form, she had simply winked and told me that she would let me know if she ever mastered it fully herself. My form blurred and ghosted, leaving misty afterimages of me in snapshots of time. It made the deadly dance I performed, blades flashing and gliding through the air, look almost ethereal. The people around me looked virtually enraptured by the display, so I smiled inwardly and thrust to each side with my blades, causing future versions of myself to burst from me as wispy white doppelgangers, each of me performing the kata in staggered points in time. This caused ooing and clapping from the excited children. I ended the kata with my own ghosts falling back into me as I caught up with them. It was something I had learned to control after using it to great success in Highland Reach when I fought against the marauders led by the wanted rogue Aelwyn, ex-Duchess of Solomon. Mother Udele believes it is a byproduct of the transference I can accomplish using my gypsy sight. I ended with Hera sliding into her sheath, and Annadele offered across my arm, hilt first to Galen. His eyes, wide from my display, widened even further. He reached out hesitantly.
May I?
I nodded, and he hefted my blade like it were a toy. He furrowed his brow.
It is so light.
He moved out to where I had performed my kata, then the boy surprised me by performing a kata of his own, with large sweeps and lunges that were punctuated by huge leg sweeps that balanced the movements as his robe fluttered behind him. It was a bit unpolished and a little clumsy,
but it was such a beautiful kata. I have never seen a knight from Hell's Gate fight before. Was this one of their katas? He finished, then offered my sword back to me.
She has a beautiful balance for a non-curved blade.
I took her, and absently sheathed her, my eyes on the boy as I asked, "How did you learn that?" It was exceedingly rare for a commoner to have any weapons training in any of the realms I had visited. He shrugged.
All children are taught the basics to defend ourselves against sand marauders.
I arched an eyebrow. That was both amazing and a little frightening that they were all trained to defend themselves, and that there was so much marauder activity in the burning desert that such a thing was needed. I absently wondered if a similar program might not benefit other realms. Then, maybe marauders wouldn't pose such a threat. And it would have the added benefit of freeing up night patrols for more troubled areas. I'd have to discuss this with Celeste. I clasped his shoulder. Well done. You would make a good knight one day. He beamed at that, as it was exceedingly rare for a commoner to become a knight. I looked around. Please. I have taken enough of your valuable time, children, when there are so many wonders waiting for you in the tomes and scrolls of the library. I have a meeting to attend. After a cute round of goodbyes, and thank you, Penny ladies, I hugged Emily and clasped Jacqueline's hand as she mouthed, "Thank you." I inclined my head and scurried off to the main doors. I would have loved to stay and watch the awe on the children's faces as they discovered wonder after wonder about the great wizards of the before. I also knew I'd have to pay for calling Emily the Queen of the Scrolls, but right now, I was about to embark upon a rescue mission a year in the making. Chapter 1. Cedar Ridge. I strode through the re-emerging town of Cedar Ridge, formerly Gus Davis Ford, until we learned of its true name, though the people of Wexbury refer to it affectionately as the Dig. More and more buildings have been excavated from the time prior to the Great Impact, which brought down the civilization of the great wizards of the before. The town, like all the others, was buried in the great earth rumbles that followed the impact. A rogue astral body had collided with Mother Luna and tore her asunder over 2,700 years aforetime. The earth was nearly destroyed, and most life and the great oceans which covered the planet's surface were wiped out. The three sisters emerged out of the debris field which ringed the earth. Mother Luna dominated the night sky with a great red eye staring down at us from the center of her oblong egg shape. Her two smaller sisters, Athena and Freya, which formed afterward, now trail behind her in an endless chase. Our scholars say that one day they will catch her in their celestial dance, and once again Mother Luna will be whole. I glanced around the improvised town square, amazed at how crowded Cedar Ridge had become. People from all the realms of Sparrow scurried about. They were drawn by the public library, the amazing wonders being unearthed daily as more of the settlement was revealed. And some more enterprising individuals had come for the crowds, to strike their fortunes peddling their wares. In just over a year, the improvised Templar's Market, as the populace refers to it, had drawn vendors from everywhere. I'm continually amazed at the craftsmanship from the realms of the Lower Ten, which I haven't had the pleasure of visiting yet. There wasn't a market anywhere with such diversity in offerings. I was also heartbroken at the sheer amount of destitute commoners who arrive daily, on the rumors of work to be had to earn coin to feed their families. Some had traveled from as far away as Hell's Gate or Far Reach in the hope the rumors were true. My steward of the dig, Yvette, put every man and woman seeking employment to work, unearthing the multiple square miles of village indicated on the ancient maps of Cedar Ridge we had found in the library. Through my own funds and the crown subsidizing, we paid an unheard-of iron penny for each week of labor. I would see none go hungry when winter struck. Any overflow of workers were sent north with the caravans to work on Prince George's massive undertaking. The great bridging of the gap was progressing at a phenomenal pace. Once thought a pie-in-the-sky idea, it was now a reality. The canal to bring irrigation across the 40-mile crossing of the uninhabitable lands between Highland and the Lower Ten had already been completed, and the ring, the cobbled highway that connected all realms, had been extended to Highland. All that remained now was to bring soil from both sides of the gap to create a mile-wide grassland for the wildlife of both regions to migrate freely between the two lands. Who would have thought I would have lived to witness the joining of the only known inhabitable lands on the planet? I smiled inwardly and corrected myself. The only known inhabitable lands until now. I hesitated when I saw a small group of people heading toward the library, looking nervous and out of place. Their clothing marked them as outsiders. I smiled widely. I could tell they weren't sure if the rumors were true, that the library was open to all. I looked toward my destination, then sighed. My Lady Celeste and the others would just have to wait for me. This was important, too. I veered off to greet the group. I admired their durable-looking clothing, and even the woman wore trousers like I had when I was a herder and scavenger. It was just more practical than dresses to work in. Their clothing was well-worn but tidily patched, and it still struck me as odd that outsiders didn't wear the colors of any realm nor gypsy band. They drifted freely through the realms, obeying the laws of the lands they traveled through, living off the land. I understood the need for freedom, to be your own master and answer to none. I envied it in them, as being a Templar I was supposed to bow to no man, but I felt more constrained, with less freedom to do as I liked than ever before at times. I stopped in front of them, and they looked as if they were ready to run away and hide in the shadows. I rasped out to them an outsider, a mashup of English, mountain gypsy, and, of all things, an ancient language virtually nobody spoke anymore, Welsh. Hello. Welcome to Cedar Ridge. Have you come for work or the library? The man who seemed to be the patriarch of their small group blinked in surprise. I understood, since not many Alti could speak outsider. I could, only because the woodcutter Korik, who had been courting my mother when I was young, had taught it to me. Mother had always said that we fail ourselves if we do not take the time to educate ourselves in all things, and that one should learn all they could in the short time we had on this earth. He slid his cap off and clenched it nervously in both hands as he looked over his people, then over to me.
Miss.
He inclined his head, his eyes creasing in slight confusion. I'm sure it was my combination of all tea and gypsy armor coupled with the magics dropping off of me in a fine white mist. Then he looked back like he wasn't sure it had been a good idea to be here. He inhaled deeply, then asked, his eyes on the three children of the group who looked to be about to become teens,
"Is it true that the tomes in this penny library are magic and can educate our children? So they would know the letters of the world and the maths. We do not have much, but we have strong backs to barter."
I felt as if I had been struck in the gut. The ache inside me was so profound. This, I told myself, this right there was the reason Mother and I had fought so hard to have Duke Frederick of Wexbury educate every last child in the realm. I nodded slowly. The knowledge inside the library can indeed impart knowledge, but it is not magic. That magic is inside of all of you, inside your children already, their ability to learn new concepts and ideas. We can help not only your children, but any of your group who wish to learn to read. It will take weeks. You can find work here while you learn. Then I spoke in a cold tone, showing my distaste. There is no cost for knowledge. It is your right as a person to be educated. We would be amiss if we did not help people to realize this right. It is the whole ideology around this public library. The children could barely contain their excitement as they fidgeted. The adults looked at me dubiously. I understood. As commoners, we are taught that we got nothing in this world which we did not sweat blood and tears for. I asked, "Do any of you speak English?" They all nodded, and the man said in broken English,
"Yes, miss. Needed we to trade with keeps."
I smiled and said in English, "Splendid." Then I caught the eye of a passing digger boy. I swear we had more and more diggers excavating every day. He hustled over when I nudged my chin toward us. The boy bowed and said in a deeper voice than I would have imagined, "Lady." I smiled at him and said, "Would you please see to it that this group meets with one of the volunteer scholars? They wish to gain the education needed to read the scrolls in the library." The boy beamed a smile at them, and his eyes widened when he saw a girl his age. The two looked quickly away from each other. It was like a magic of its own when a crush is kindled to life into this world. He said to me with enthusiasm as he bowed again,
"Lady."
Then he told the group, purposefully trying not to glance at the girl every 2 seconds, who was now bashfully brushing her dark hair back over her ear,
"If you would follow me, please."
The man offered an arm to me, noted the dirt and dust from travel on his weather-beaten skin, and started to pull back. But I clasped his arm in enthusiasm.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?